So it's tomorrow, mister. Tomorrow they begin writing the peace for the world?
That's right, young man. And once the peace comes, remember, you must tend it. You must guard it. If this peace is lost, you may never have another. For this is the first peace in the atomic age.
The National Broadcasting Company presents The National Hour. This is a mirror of public opinion, reflecting what America and the world are thinking, planning, doing. This is today's interpretation of the problems and the newsworthy milestones we must reach and pass on the road to peace and reconstruction. Today, July 28th, 1946, we present the 37th in the distinguished NBC series, The National Hour. Our subject for today,
The Long Dawning.
Ten months ago, the final hostile chapters of World War II were ended. The book of war was closed.
Tomorrow, in Paris, for the second time within this generation, the world begins to move toward the bright sun of lasting peace.
And the people hope and fear and pray. The story of their fears and their hopes is our subject for today.
The Long Dawning.
This is Robert St. John in New York. War, you know, is not a natural phenomenon. It must be made by men. Likewise, the matter of peace. In Paris tomorrow, the delegates of the 21 allied nations begin the waging of peace. And behind this conference are the ghosts of past conferences that failed. Behind this conference are 14 months of international bickering, swapping, and compromise. To document the present attitudes and problems, we shall call in from Paris NBC correspondents Henry Cassidy and Merrill Muller.
This is Robert McCormick in Washington, which is now one of the world's four strategic centers in the weaving of the network of peace. And as the representatives and the experts of the peace-seeking nations gather in Paris, the people of the world, the people who fight and pay for the wars, the people remember and pray and question their future. To answer one of these questions, the question of how the Organization of the United Nations will complement and strengthen the decisions for peace, we shall hear from Mr. Andrew Cordier, Executive Assistant to the Secretary General of the United Nations. We are standing by.
How do you do? What can I do for you, young man?
I don't know.
Look around you. You see the kind of shop this is?
Yes. It's the kind I'm looking for, but, well, there's a special one.
Was it something you wanted to pawn or something you wanted to redeem?
Well, I pawned something. It was a long time ago. Now I want to redeem what I pawned, but I'm not sure if this is the place.
Do you have a claim check?
Yes.
Let me have a look at it.
Here it is. You see, when they gave it to me, they stamped it Victory and Honorable Discharge.
Yes, yes, I see.
Then am I in the right place, mister?
Yes, young man. Take a look at the sign behind you.
The Cosmic Pawn Shop.
So, you've come to the right place, just as all the others who've been coming. But...
What's wrong, mister?
Nothing, nothing, young man. Only you've come too early.
What do you mean, I've come too early?
No, no, don't get heated. The pledge on that ticket will be made good.
But I put up my life.
I know. But unfortunately, that is the common collateral in this shop.
What's common about putting up your life?
I was only speaking in the sense of this business.
When you have only one life, I'd call it highly uncommon.
Yes, yes, I understand. But you'll have to wait. You'll have to be patient.
Maybe I'm a little impatient, but I'm here to collect the peace that's due me. Where is the world peace for which I put up my life?
Oh, it takes time, my son. A war can be ended overnight, but it takes time and thought to manufacture a good and lasting peace. Much time, much thought.
What do you mean, a good and lasting peace? Can a peace be a bad one?
Yes, it can and has been. Any peace that's just an excuse for long-lasting revenge is a bad one. And that's why it takes time and thought to make a good peace. Yes, my boy, it does. The past 25 centuries offer many, many examples. But to understand how these things happen, let us choose one example. Let us call the two nations involved by Sepia and Talmania. It begins when, after a war between the two nations, the representatives of the victorious Bisepians present to the Talmanians a treaty to establish the peace.
The terms of the peace. Representatives of the Talmanian nation, have you read the terms of the treaty?
Yes. We have read them.
Very well, then. Take the pen and sign. Let us conclude the matter. What's wrong? Why don't you sign?
It is difficult for me to bind my people to these terms.
Indeed.
There is practically nothing left us. Neither land, nor water, nor industries. Not even honor. Nothing.
What of your lives?
Under the circumstance, even our lives will belong more to you than to us. The war has done terrible things to our country. This peace will complete the destruction.
Perhaps so, then again, perhaps not. But whichever, you unfortunately are in no position to bargain or to demand.
True, but all we ask is a small measure of justice.
We shall give you what you deserve.
This peace will not last.
Do you still dare to threaten?
No. I will sign. But this peace will breed war. It will happen perhaps long after this generation is gone. But it will happen.
And so it did, young man. After four generations, four generations of rancor and resentment, the two countries were at war again.
But all that's history. What I want to know is, what about right now, the present? What about the United States?
Young man, 28 years ago, your father asked the same question. He also fought through a war and returned to ask the same question. I remember the day. I remember it.
The day was November 11th, 1918, and the place was the White House in Washington. Early in that day, President Woodrow Wilson penciled a message to the people.
My fellow countrymen, the armistice was signed this morning. Everything for which America fought has been accomplished. It will now be our fortunate duty to assist by example, by sober friendly counsel, and by material aid in the establishment of just democracy throughout the world.
3 weeks later, the president sailed for France. He went to the peace conference at Versailles with the understanding that the decisions would be governed by his world-acclaimed 14 points.
Open covenants openly arrived at.
Freedom of the seas.
Free trade among nations.
Self-determination. Impartial adjustment of colonial claim.
A league of nations to uphold a peaceful world order.
When Wilson arrived in Europe, he was frantically hailed by the people as the Moses who would lead them to lasting peace. But for unannounced reasons, the opening of the conference was delayed for more than 1 month. To the expert observers, this was a dark and a disheartening omen.
I don't understand it, Jim.
You don't understand what?
Here I'm sweating blood all across the Atlantic because I'm 2 weeks late. And now I get here and nothing's happening. Why are they stalling?
They're waiting, that's all.
Who?
Lloyd George and Clemenceau and the Italian and Japanese delegates. They're waiting until the hullabaloo over the 14 points dies down and the people begin to think about something else.
But why? I thought they were for the points, too.
Yeah, so they said. But when it comes down to carving up and distributing Europe, then the 14 points might prove embarrassing.
Wilson will never stand for that.
Maybe he won't at first. But he does want a peace treaty. He does want his League of Nations. And to get them, he'll be forced to compromise.
You're painting it pretty black.
I hope I am. But wait and see.
Gentlemen, before we go any further, I wish to point out that we're not running a treaty of peace, but an instrument of revenge.
But the Boche are murderers, Monsieur Wilson. What rights do they have to insist on?
The rights we promised to protect when they surrendered. You were a signer of that document, Monsieur Clemenceau. But I can see not even a glimmer of justice in the petition of Germany as suggested by France and agreed to by England.
I am, first of all, a Frenchman, Monsieur Wilson. And we have not forgotten the peace treaty Germany dictated to us in Vienna in 1871.
And may I point out that Europe faces serious problems which we must now anticipate.
And I thought America and Europe shared these problems, Mr. George.
Well, except that America is separated from us by one ocean and protected by another. But we face the danger of Bolshevik Russia. A powerless Germany will be our strongest defense in Europe.
No, gentlemen. The League of Nations will be the world's greatest defense against aggression and war.
The League has yet to come into being. And despite your great faith, Mr. Wilson, your Senate may not approve the League.
They cannot isolate America any longer.
That we shall see. But this peace treaty is an immediate affair.
It's quite. Shall we proceed, gentlemen?
Well, Jim, the Senate just brought down the curtain on President Wilson's dream of peace. They just voted down the League of Nations.
There was no hope. Now, America draws back into its shell of isolation.
What happens now with us and with the world?
Take your choice. We can pray for a miracle or prepare for war.
Twenty years later, the war came. Fascist Germany, the bulwark against Russia, sought vengeance against the world for the Peace of Versailles. And it became a war in which ideologies became weapons, just as did rocket bombs and radar. The aims of the Allies against the Axis, the aims of the war and of the peace to come, were carefully considered and set down.
The Atlantic Charter.
The Moscow Declaration.
The Potsdam Declaration.
The Charter of the United Nations.
Now, as the nations assemble to discuss the written peace, there is already in existence an organization of 51 nations sworn and united to maintain international peace and security. And now the question arises, how will UN function in relation to the peace once established? For the answer to that question, we call upon Mr. Andrew Cordier, Executive Assistant to the Secretary General of the United Nations. Mr. Cordier.
First, it is important to observe the limitations placed upon the United Nations by the Charter. The purpose and effect of Articles 106 and 107 of the Charter was to leave to the governments primarily responsible for the defeat of an enemy state the determination of the terms of the peace and, in general, the taking of necessary enforcement measures. The placing of these major responsibilities in the hands of the victorious powers leaves many questions open with regard to the timing and the character of the transfer of responsibilities from such nations to the United Nations. Article 107 does not preclude, however, the possibility of placing on the United Nations responsibilities for enforcement of the terms of the treaties if the states responsible for the military defeat of an enemy state so agree. We already have one notable illustration of a partial shift of responsibility from the victorious states to the United Nations in the case of Trieste. The transfer of responsibilities from the treaty makers to the United Nations will be particularly striking in the case of those enemy nations which will eventually be admitted to membership in the United Nations. Such nations would assume full partnership in the family of nations, and all provisions of the Charter pertaining to the rights and responsibilities of members would naturally be applicable to them.
Another question, Mr. Cordier. How will the United Nations participate in upholding and strengthening the peace?
Well, one interesting development with regard to the character of the peace might be noted. The Commission on Human Rights, in its recent meeting at Hunter College, passed a resolution which was in turn endorsed by the Economic and Social Council, emphasizing the importance of human rights in international treaties. It is clear that a just peace, a peace based upon fundamental human rights, is likely also to be a stable peace. Furthermore, the numerous provisions in the machinery and procedures of the United Nations for the amelioration of the economic and social problems of the world should undergird the peace. A vigorous promotion of United Nations activity in the numerous areas of life provided for under the Charter should go far toward making satisfactory treaties a stable part of future world life.
Thank you, Mr. Cordier.
Peace, like war, does not just happen. Both must be prepared for. Even in the latter months of the war, official but off-the-record preparations were being made for tomorrow's conference. The preparations were largely talk around the question, how much will Russia want, and what will she get? That problem has been the subject of serious study. President Roosevelt gave it much thought, especially after the Yalta conference, during which he considered the broad issues of the peace with Premier Stalin. One insight into Mr. Roosevelt's feelings on the matter at that time is given by the former Assistant Secretary of State, Adolph A. Burley, Jr., in an article in the August issue of the American magazine. The president had discussed the subject privately with Mr. Burley following Mr. Roosevelt's return from Yalta. Mr. Burley's article summarizes that conversation as follows.
The Soviet Union, Mr. Roosevelt thought, was looking for security rather than empire. But security can take you very far. Nationalist aims can expand into empire-seeking quite easily. But the president was even more concerned over the policy of the British Tories. He described it as being about the policy of 1890. It was proposed to build a West European bloc to balance power against Russia. He was unhappy about the prospects. Unless a settlement could be reached by world agreement along the line of a general good neighbor policy administered through a world organization, the president felt another war was probably a matter of time. Mr. Roosevelt thought that both the Soviet Union and the British would have to be shown that this could and must be done.
Finally, the time came for actual and official preparations for peace. Three times since VJ Day, the foreign ministers of the Big Four have met to seek an area of common agreement on preliminary questions and procedures so that the World Conference might be assembled.
What's the stumbling block now?
Trieste, and it's a beaut. Russia wants it for Yugoslavia, we want it for Italy. France and England are with us. They don't want too much Russian influence in the Mediterranean.
So what happens to the peace conference now?
We won't know unless Russia gives in or agrees to some kind of compromise.
The compromise was made. A complicated compromise on a compromise, which may or may not have settled the problem. And a compromise was reached on Italian reparations to be paid to Russia. And thus, delicately and painfully, the road to the conference was cleared of disagreement. And finally, the decision was made.
In Paris, on July 29th, tomorrow, the representatives of 21 nations will meet to arrange the peace of World War II. The first point of business on the agenda, the consideration of treaties with the five former enemy countries, Italy, Romania, Bulgaria, Hungary, Finland.
As a matter of fact, Washington is officially, sincerely, and perhaps overly optimistic. One likely reason is the result of the last Big Four foreign ministers meeting in Paris. Secretary of State Burns undoubtedly feels he has the Soviet through Foreign Minister Molotov, all sewed up on the big issues.
But I've watched the Russians function in the Security Council up here. And does one ever really get them sewed up on anything?
Well, one decisive test is coming up. These peace treaties will be no surprise to anyone involved. Tentative drafts with several proposed alternatives have been sent to the 21 nations, and these 21 nations should know even now what they think of the treaties. But the big four foreign ministers must approve the treaties finally chosen, and we want the foreign ministers to meet while the conference is still going on or immediately after it ends, and approve or disapprove the treaties just as fast as the peace conference can grind them out, sort of a beltline production. If the Russians follow their usual tactics, they will try to stall by delaying the foreign ministers' meeting until some time after the conference ends. That will be our first big test. Watch for it.
Then, too, there's the question of the presidency of the peace conference. The big four want to rotate it, that is, between the United States, Russia, Britain, and France. The smaller nations want to get in on this rotation, or they want to elect one permanent head of the conference.
And then there was another worry which may be revived, whether the conference decisions shall be by a mere majority vote or whether they must get a two-thirds vote. The conference will work through five committees, one for each of the five Nazi satellite countries. The two-thirds rule will apply to these committees, but any country objecting to a decision may complain to the whole conference. So no country or group of countries can have anything like the veto power that the Russians use so freely to control the work of the United Nations Security Council.
In short, there will be a considerable amount of jockeying of politicking over in Paris. It's already begun. The delegates are now in Paris, and the world prays and waits and looks toward Paris. Russia still looms as the great question mark. For an analysis of Russia's hopes and desires and strategy on the eve of the peace conference, we take you now to Paris and NBC correspondent Henry Cassidy.
All during the year since the end of World War II, the great powers have labored to make lasting peace for Europe. And whenever the going got tough, when the big four came down to cases and fell into disagreement, the division was almost always the same, 3-1. The United States, Britain, and France on one side against Russia alone on the other side. Tomorrow, when the peace conference of 21 powers convenes to go over the treaties for Italy, Finland, and the Balkans, the division will be the same, expanded a bit numerically, but still in the same proportions and with the same inspiration. The Western Allies and their friends on one side against Russia and her cohorts on the other. So it's a fair question to ask, what is it that sets the Soviet Union apart from the Western world, and what is the Soviet approach to the peace treaties? And that's exactly the question that I put to a Soviet diplomat. He replied with a touch of bitterness that despite the misunderstanding or perhaps bad will that beclouded the issue, the answer was easy. The one thing the Soviet Union wants from the peace treaties is that they keep the peace. And obvious as his remark may seem, it made a point that is often forgotten, and it formed a base for the typical Russian line of logical thinking. Fundamentally, the Russians say they want peace. Therefore, they need security, and therefore they require assurance of Big Four cooperation. The Russians feel that Big Four cooperation must be based on the word already given and the agreements already signed at Tehran, Yalta, and Potsdam, including maintenance of the veto power. They resent most of all attempts to revise these agreements and attacks on the veto. And in the absence of complete understanding, they are playing power politics to protect their own interests. The Russians emphasize two points in the peace treaties, that former enemies must be punished severely, but that having paid for their crimes, they must be left complete sovereignty. It may be argued that in demanding punishment, the Russians are simply exacting cash reparations. And on the sovereign rights of enemies, the Russians are making a propaganda play for Italy and keeping the Western powers out of the Balkans. But there can hardly be any argument on their principles. And despite all the quarrels that went into the making of the draft treaties, the Russians profess a good deal of satisfaction with the documents that go before the 21 powers, carrying Big Four unanimity on all except a few minor points. And now for a discussion of the Allied approach to the peace treaties, here is NBC correspondent Merrill Muller. In the longest and most hopeful allied view of the Paris Peace Conference, the world's compromise with communism has created a headless and heartless dove to which only Moscow can now give life. Russian goodwill must be relied upon to develop ahead for this body by renewed and closer cooperation in Germany, and to develop a heart and pulse by liberating Austria and strictly adhering to the four freedoms. Thus, Paris is looked upon as the first transfusion in the revival of peace, and has already cost the surrender of a number of allied principles, but is well worth the price if the ultimate goal is achieved. Right now, much cynicism and many doubts are heard, and it's amazing the number of diplomats who share and even repeat the commoner's expressions. The full measure of agreement among the Big Four, and subsequently among the 21, is undoubted on the military clauses of the satellite treaties. But there, cooperation ends. That, however, is not the only position where the Big Four have something in common. For much as the Western allies have ballyhooed their terms as humanitarian and ethnic, they show trends of vengeance similar to Russia's aggressive totalitarian policy. For the allies, this is evidenced in the Balkan treaties for restoration and indemnity on vested interests, and for countering Russia's infiltration in Germany by protecting the greatest enemy from Balkan demands. Russia, of course, gets more than her pound of flesh from Little Finland, which must again pay for an Arctic war which the Soviets initiated. But the real allied view of the so-called peace conference lies much deeper and concerns five main points. The first of these is whether Russia will actually permit restoration of freedom in the satellites around her. Recent communization activities in Hungary, as well as allied reluctance to accept Balkan governments, is evidence that these clauses are just so much type on paper. Secondly, regardless of the hard and compromising efforts of Secretary of State Burns and Foreign Ministers Bevan and Beto, Trieste is still considered a festering cancer on the peace dove's body, with the same threatening complications as Danzig to the dove of 1939. Thirdly, the Allies pin great hopes on Russian awareness of good faith, respect, and trust in acceptance of the above terms, and expect such awareness to ease Russian objections to the settling of the Austrian question. Fourthly, such latter progress must improve Allied relations in Germany and restore efforts to recreate Germany at least as an economic entity. Otherwise, Potsdam is completely invalidated and the ex-Nazi nation becomes a fully open political and economic battleground of the world's two current ideologies. Finally, it's feared that unless Paris successfully concludes the satellite treaties without further Western compromises, a more dangerous class of interest will take place in the Far East before the European treaties are completed and dry. And now back to the National Hour in New York.
So it's tomorrow, mister? Tomorrow's the big day.
Yes, young man. Tomorrow, they will begin making the peace that is due to you.
Okay. And I hope when it comes through, it has all the specifications that were promised.
With all my heart, I hope so. But remember, once you have it, you can't sit back and say, it's here now and it'll stay. No. You must tend it. You must guard it. If this peace is lost, there may never come another. For this is the first peace in the atomic age.
On the subject of the peace conference, then, our documentary is closed.
But this is Robert St. John inviting you to listen to the National Hour again next Sunday, when our subject will be The Prisons We Deserve.
This has been the National Hour. From New York and Washington and Paris, we have brought you the 37th in this series of current affairs and national problems. Our guest speaker was Andrew Cordier, Executive Assistant to the Secretary General of the United Nations, and NBC correspondents Henry Cassidy and Merrill Muller. Robert St. John was your narrator, with Robert McCormick reporting from Washington. This is NBC, the National Broadcasting Company.